Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there, and you're very welcome to the programme. Coming up today, show business legend Brendan Grace and his wife Eileen will be here to talk about his very successful career, their long marriage, and why recently Eileen felt the need to defend him. Also today, we'll hear how one woman reclaimed her power when she confronted the man who attacked her, and now that meeting has become a film. Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, first this morning, in 2005, Alva Griffith, when she was just 21, was walking home when she was attacked and viciously sexually assaulted, during which she thought she was going to die. But she survived and the man was caught and convicted. But for Alva, the ordeal wasn't over as she tried to continue with her life. It wasn't until she made the decision to meet up with this man, her attacker, that she was finally able to move on. And this meeting, part of a form of restorative justice, has now been made into a film simply called The Meeting. And Alva, who plays herself in the film, and the film's director, Alan Gilson, join me in studio now. Thank you both very much for coming in.
Thank you, Mary.
Pleasure.
Alva, let me start with you, if it's okay.
Yep.
Do you mind just, what happened to you in 2005? Just for my listeners who may not know your story, what did happen to you?
Sure. Well, I had basically just graduated from university, and it was just an in-between period when I was going to go back and do a postgraduate course. I was working in town, just kind of saving a bit of money to go abroad with some friends. And I was travelling home one night on public transport, and basically I was followed off that the bus, and subsequently ambushed and attacked by the man that followed me off the bus. He, you know, was really quite violent, and obviously there was a sexual assault as well. And it just so happened that I was basically rescued by two individuals who passed by on the street. And obviously, you know, I'm very grateful that they did that. But they also apprehended this person. And I managed to escape, obviously, and kind of run back towards my house at that point. I did pursue things via the criminal justice system. I went straight to the Gardaí that morning. And basically, you know, I suppose, you know, that experience was challenging, but obviously critical. And I would always kind of say that, you know, people should really go down that route, no matter how kind of challenging it is in some respects. So basically, you know, I went via the court, and then there was a conviction there. There was a guilty plea, so I didn't actually need to go through the process of a trial. And I suppose, you know, that, although, I mean, in some respects, that's kind of the best you can get out of the criminal justice system, I would say. You know, I had that kind of positive outcome via the criminal justice system. But, you know, following that, I kind of felt that there was a lot of kind of, I suppose, emotional and psychological trauma, and that really wasn't healed per se by the criminal justice system. I don't feel that it in of itself kind of resolves that piece for the victim of crime. So I suppose I tried a load of different avenues, you know, all the kind of the tick the box ones, and they just weren't working for me, you know. And I kind of continued to feel a lot of, I suppose, a lot of a sense of a disempowerment. So no matter how kind of successful I was in life, there was always this kind of memory that would disempower me. Mm-hmm. And I also carried a lot of kind of sadness and anger as a result of the attack. And then piece by piece, you know, when something might trigger off a memory of the attack, I would begin to imagine like confronting this individual. So I would, you know, picture maybe going up to him and making a statement about how it made me feel when, you know, when he did what he did, or I'd have a question for him, you know, like, why did you do what you did? You know, because I just couldn't understand, I couldn't grasp, you know, what was behind it. And just being the type of person that I am, and we all come in different kind of shapes and sizes, but I wanted to have an understanding, you know, and I wanted to complete a kind of a, this fragmented picture. I mean, it seemed so chaotic to me. I wanted to kind of solidify that chaos in some ways. So it just so happened that I was speaking to one of my sisters one day, and she mentioned Dr. Marie Keenan, who is a restorative justice practitioner. She's a psychotherapist, and she also is a lecturer in UCD. And I basically approached Marie, and she agreed to meet with me. And I basically recounted my story to her, and basically said, you know, I really feel that I want to confront this person, you know. And I gave her, you know, the background there. And at the end of that meeting, she said to me, you know, it sounds like, you know, you want a restorative justice meeting, so I will help you with that. So, I mean, that was just amazing for me. Even from that point, I felt already this kind of dark cloud lifting, you know, because I felt, you know, a hope that, that I hadn't had before. And, you know, that process itself in getting into the room with this individual was quite long. It took basically a year and a half to get there. Throughout that period, I would say there were, you know, even with initiating that process with this person, I began to feel some relief. So, for instance, when eventually he was contacted and asked, will you meet with her? I already felt a sense of empowerment because, you know, I knew that he knew that I wasn't afraid to meet him, you know. So I think that's just an important point to make, because, you know, people always assume it has to end up with you being in the room with that person. But even these small kind of movements in that direction can really, really help. And then obviously, you know, it came to the day and, you know, I entered the room and met with this person. And basically that has become, you know, the film now that that recounts basically the story of what happened in the room.
And it's really powerful. I watched it, actually. It's superb. And we'll come back to that, Alan. But you know, when you walked into that room, A, who was in the room? Just tell my listeners. And B, how did you feel? Did you want to go up and thump him? I mean, what was your instinct?
Sure. Well, I mean, the entire process is very well kind of defined and orchestrated. I mean, there is a very defined process in place for any restorative justice meeting, and there's a lot of preparation work involved. So, like, for instance, I knew, you know, who would be sitting where at the table. There tends to be two facilitators, obviously the two parties involved, or if there are more, and then there would be support people as well for the victim and also the offender. So in my case, there were six people there altogether. I suppose, you know, this has been building for such a long time. I had a very defined sense of, you know, what I wanted to achieve out of the meeting. And basically it was, well, first and foremost, it was probably regaining a sense of empowerment again. So, you know, I felt that by going in there, you know, I would see this person as a human. They would no longer be kind of that monster, that person that, I suppose, you know, comes out of the darkness and drags you into a bush, you know. I could actually face the human being. Mm-hmm. And that would definitely decrease my sense of fear and, you know, give me that sense of empowerment again. I wanted to humanize him for two reasons, for the fear factor, but also because, you know, which was something that I personally had set out to do, which was to forgive him. And my reason for, you know, wanting to do that really was more because I had carried all this kind of anger and the sadness for so many years. And I felt I basically had come to the realization that, like, the only person that was really suffering in that was me, because he didn't know about it. And even if he did, I felt he probably wouldn't care. So, I mean, once you acknowledge the futility of that, you know, of carrying that, you know, I felt like the only way to get rid of that was really to forgive him. But that's all very kind of, I suppose, you know, that's the kind of the theory side of it, and you actually have to do that. So, I mean, the only way I felt I could achieve that was actually to face the human and, you know, maybe just gain a sense of compassion for him, you know. So when I went into that room, you know, I was actually able to achieve all those things. And it really was so hugely transformative for me in that way.
Did you feel like you were in a more powerful position than him in the room? And did you? You said you wanted to forgive him.
Mm.
Did you forgive him?
I did forgive him in that room. Yeah, I did. You know, I was able to, as I mentioned, sit across the table from a human. You know, and I suppose it wasn't so much maybe what he was saying. It wasn't so much, you know, the stories that he told. It was more looking across the table at a human that was, I suppose, really struggling, just struggling in a sense to exist, to have some sense of normality, you know, in their lives. And, you know, I couldn't help but feel a compassion for him, you know. I think that's a very human instinct. And, you know, he also was humanizing me as well, which was one of the reasons I was in there as well. I wanted to kind of present, look, I'm actually a person here, and you need to acknowledge that, and you have made me suffer in this way, and I was very descriptive in that, you know. And you know, that was not only kind of cathartic, but it was almost honoring my suffering in that, you know, by telling him exactly what he had done and exactly how he'd made me suffer, you know. And I was able to kind of basically leave it in the room then, because, you know, it had been acknowledged by the very person that had caused it.
He didn't have to come along, did he?
That's right. I mean, yeah, it's all a voluntary kind of process. You know, there was no kind of legal obligation or anything like that on him to come. So, I mean, you have to give him credit for that as well. You know, he did turn up on the day, you know, I'm grateful for that. You know, I suppose it would also be important to say, like, something like this always would have to be kind of victim initiated, you know, especially in the context of serious crime. That's really important, you know.
But it's wonderful for you, and we'll talk about the film now, because it completely, in a way, changed everything for you, didn't it, Alva?
It did.
Which is superb. It meant you could almost go on with your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it was really and truly transformative for me. You know, I carried, like, once I walked out of that room, I literally felt physically lighter, you know, and that's not something I can really explain, but I did. And I couldn't stop smiling. And, you know, I felt really healed at a very core level. So, you know, that's how transformative it was for me. I mean, I know different people have different levels of, I suppose, benefit from it, but, you know,
for you,
that's what it was for me.
Alan Gilson, how did you come across Alva's story?
Well, I mean, I suppose it happened through a series of wonderful coincidences, but effectively our great producer, Tomás Hardiman, had met Marie Keenan. And Tomás is a man who's a profound interest in areas of trauma and forgiveness and always exploring that. And he said, come and have lunch with Marie, with no particular agenda. And over lunch, as Marie talked about the work she was doing, she told me Alva's story. And, you know, it's funny sitting with you this morning, listening to Alva again, and I know the story intimately, probably too well at this stage, but I'm reminded how extraordinary it is. I mean, the strength, the dignity, the generosity of Alva, but also that in this meeting, this kind of rather banal meeting, or certainly in a banal room, 80 minutes, something extraordinary happened, something really quite profound. And as Marie told me the story over lunch, as we left that lunch, I said to them, also, there's a film in that, just literally the meeting. And I suppose I was struck that, you know, we live in an era of kind of righteous anger, particularly from women. Totally understandable. I mean, we've seen it no more recently than this week, what's happening with the Supreme Court in the States. You know, we're at an extraordinary moment in time. But what Alva seemed to show us, I felt, was a way beyond the anger and also the kind of the harsh realities of men against women, that she seemed to have found some way of healing that. And that's not to forget the trauma, you know, which is really harrowing, more harrowing than Alva's recalled this morning. And I suppose making the film, we were always trying to balance that this was coming from Alva, a redemptive story, a hopeful story. And you had to hold that hope in one hand, but in the other hand, never forget the depth of the crime. And I think that's the power of restorative justice. It isn't some sort of soft, liberal process that sort of forgives everything, you know. And certainly making the film, it was very important that we never forgot how really, really, really horrendous the crime was. But just hearing that story from Marie and then later from Alva, it just felt like this was something in a very pure form that we needed to share.
And you do get that balance perfectly in the meeting. But the interesting thing is, it's a film. But tell me how you decide in the end to cast Alva as herself, because that wasn't always the plan.
No, not at all. I always intended to cast an actress as Alva, as we did with The Offender, Terry O'Neill, extraordinary actor.
Yeah, great performance.
Yeah, really amazing guy. But there was something about it that even went against my directorial instincts, because I knew it was a risk taking somebody who'd never acted before. But there's a certain kind of power in Alva, sparing her blushes here beside me. And there's a uniqueness about her experience.
Yeah.
That I just kept coming back to her and feeling that she had to play herself. And I suppose that was helped in a way because Alva had prepared, as she said this morning, very carefully for the meeting. And she's also somebody who's I've come to know is very steely and very composed. And so it seemed to be, even though it was a risk, it seemed to be a natural fit.
Yeah, no, and it is. How did you feel when you said, would you play yourself?
Well, a bit surprised, but at the same time, I kind of very instinctively felt, you know, that it was the right thing. You know, I felt, you know, obviously, as Anna just said, they were sticking very closely to how the meeting unfolded, and I felt really the authenticity of the meeting and the power of restorative justice would come especially through if, you know, I was sitting there presenting as I did on the very day, you know, speaking the words that I spoke, virtually. And I felt that I could, you know, contribute to that authenticity and therefore that the power of it, really, the transformative nature of it.
I think it's incredibly powerful because it is you playing yourself. Listen, our listeners are going in complete awe of this brave woman, Miriam. That's from Anne. Miriam, your guest is such a brave young woman, speaking personally as a victim of abuse. I could have recovered if the abuser apologised to me. It still haunts me. That's from Margaret. And one more. Miriam said, just wondering, did that man who attacked your guest want forgiveness as distinct from just compassion? Did forgiveness matter to him as well as to you? That's a good question. Did it?
I mean, it is a good question, but I will say, you know, I went in there completely focused on what I wanted to get out of it, you know. And, you know, I don't think he ever wanted or necessarily expected forgiveness from me, but I actually did that for myself, if you know what I mean. I forgave him for me, not for him, because, you know, and hopefully it did benefit him to move on through his life. But, you know, I felt it would free me from the negativity of that experience, and it did, to be honest. So,
well, look, this great film, The Meeting, it's all around the country, isn't it, Alan?
Yes.
And there's some questions and answer sessions. Tell me about that.
Yes, we've been doing a series of question and answer sessions, and I'm sure we'll continue to do that. I mean, people are eager to engage, particularly with Alva. You know, I think hers is a remarkable testimony, and it, you know, deserves to be heard.
And would you recommend it finally, Alva, for if there is someone else listening, like one of those women who just wrote into us who is an abuser, would you recommend it to someone else, the restorative justice?
I think absolutely if the person wants it, they should definitely, you know, move forward in the process if they can. But definitely it has to be something coming from that person, you know, that they would want it.
And I was struck, sorry, Miriam, I was struck recently somewhere in the country when we did a question answer. There were one or two women stood up at the end, having heard Alva's story, having seen the film, and said they came to the film full of trepidation. But in actual fact, what the film had given them was some hope that they could transcend their own trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think, if anything else, that's the core of Alva's story.
Yeah, and so, as all the listeners are saying, you are so brave and courageous to have told the story. It's a great film. It's The Meeting. Everyone should try and catch it. Alva Griffith, Alan Gisnell, thanks so much for coming in this morning. We'll take a break.
Thank you.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551. You can email miriam at rte.ie. I'm laughing. Brendan Grace is sitting in front of me with like four scribbles of notes. I need those when I'm on prime time, Brendan.
You should see me on stage.
Anyway, I'm joined in studio by Brendan Grace, our most well-known and best-loved comedian, and his career has spanned, of course, the last four decades of Irish life. A new RT documentary airs tomorrow night, 9:35 RT1. I've seen it. It's superb. But he hasn't done it on his own. By his side, throughout that time, since 1974, and by his side this morning in our studio, is his wife, Eileen, and I'm delighted to say you're here as well. Yeah. Good morning to you both.
It's great to see you.
Great to see you both. Thanks so much. Listen, before we start...
Before we start, Miriam, yes, can I Brendan? Just say, you look lovely here today. So different to the TV. To see you there in the negligent is so nice. Do you come in a taxi in that? In
yes,
the head?
Oh, I do. Just for you, Brendan.
Oh my God, he's dreaming already.
But you got annoyed recently.
Yeah.
Because, tell me, because you had a mini stroke.
He had a mini stroke, yeah. And we never spoke about it before.
Yeah.
Brendan just couldn't deal with it. So over the last couple of years, I have been at the shows watching people's reaction, hearing stuff. And I just thought, oh my God, people think he's drunk.
Mm.
And that would be the furthest from Brendan because he's such a professional person. I thought, oh, it has to be said.
Yeah, you because know, in other words, the mini stroke affected
His balance, his speech, even the way he looked. He looked a bit grey in the face for a couple of years. He's back to himself now. Mm. But his manager, Brian and Tom, they were hearing things too. So we were all kind of worried for him.
Mm.
So when this documentary came up...
He's writing now. Whatever he's writing.
Your name, I'm just writing now. It's not catching.
But when the documentary came up, I thought, well, this is my opportunity to put it right. Because I'd hate for anybody to think that he was drunk.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he had an accident a couple of years later, and then that interfered with his stance, or his girth, as he likes to call it.
Yeah.
So he was really looking bad for a while, but he's thankfully he's back to himself.
Brendan, do you...
Would you marry me again?
Of course.
Thanks.
Yeah. Should actually, we'll go back and then we'll go forward about the illnesses. So where did you meet Eileen, Brendan?
Well, I was doing a gig in the Talbot Hotel in Wexford.
Okay.
What was the year?
72.
My
we're two antiques, by the way.
No, you're looking good, antiques.
And I was on the stage down there. Charlie Sinner was the manager then. And he gave me a spot on the show. Top of the bill was Frank O'Donovan, Batty from the Reardons. I was backing him up, mostly singing. And I heard this laughter in the audience. And it was this...
Imagine your laugh getting you into that kind of trouble.
Yeah, her laugh was so beautiful that I came down to tell her to shut up.
No, you didn't.
Because I was singing at the time.
How old were you around then?
I think I was 20.
You had just turned 21.
Wasn't called 21.
Where did you grow up, Brendan? Tell me about your background and your family.
Well, my background, I grew up in the Liberties in Dublin. And then I moved to James Street, to Eckland Street, which was right underneath Guinness's Brewery. And I grew up there. And it was from there that I actually... What started me off in the show business was that I had an accident off a motorbike when I was 16 or something, 17. And a cousin of mine who came to the house to visit me one day said there was these two guys starting a ballet group. And but I joined them and I said, well, because I was learning the guitar, which I never really played in the ballet group. But my granny and my aunt Wynne, my lovely aunt Wynne, she was a model at the time, Wynne Myler. And she bought me the guitar. I learned a couple of chords and I went on stage as a singer with the Ginger Men, and then we got a fourth member, Desi. He came in, so there was John, Paul, Desi and Brendan in the Ginger Men.
And you were very successful.
There was a guy called Patrick Crane at the time, took us over as a manager. And I always remember he suggested that we dress the part. And we went in, because the Emmett Spiceland group were already out.
Mm.
And they looked fabulous in their frilly shirts. So Patrick Crane took us into Louis Copeland.
Good old Louis.
In Cable Street. Now, I'm not talking about the Louis there now.
Right.
I'm talking about his father, old Louis.
Yeah.
And I remember we went in to get fitted for these beautiful black suits for a ballet group. And we were driving around on two Honda 90s.
Oh,
like the suits and the guitars were on our back. And we went in and we started singing beautiful harmonies. And we won then a ballet competition called the Mitchelstown Cheers Ballet Contest. And we won a recording contract. And guess what, Miriam?
What?
We never did. We never recorded.
Why?
We don't have any recording. We just didn't get around to doing it.
You actually have and had, you had a very good singing voice.
Had?
Does he still sing, by the way?
He does, yeah.
I'm not going to ask
he
you.
He does sing, yeah.
I sing to Eileen every single night.
Yeah. So when did you make the transition from singer and guitar player to comedian? Like, were you always funny when you were in the Ginger Man?
Yeah, well, I was a bit of a clown. You see, Maria, my birthday, and I keep saying this to people, is April 1st. So I was born on April Fool's Day. So my mother, God be with her, she said to herself, probably, I'm going to bring a clown into the world. So maybe that's why I was acting the go.
When you were only five, didn't you get up on stage and sing
Gard Mórí R.I.T.
at 5 years of age?
When first I came to Dublin town to Gundowl Ballyclee. And I was in the choir, if you like. But I was only five or six.
Yeah.
So that was my first attempt. But I don't even remember that. How do you remember it?
Oh, I know.
You didn't know
me then.
He knows
my family. Yeah. But when did you realise you could make an audience laugh?
I'll tell you, when John and Paul in the group would break a string, we couldn't afford to buy new strings in those days. So they used to have to tie a knot on the string, put it back in and put the clip in to hold it. And sometimes that would take 5, maybe 10 minutes. And I had to step forward and tell them jokes that I heard. I mean, you're too young, Miriam, to remember Dingo.
I actually don't remember.
No, Dingo was a great radio comedian. Because I'm a radio buff. I love radio.
Okay.
And I remember telling jokes that he would tell. And that's how I started telling jokes. And then I went solo. You know, we just broke up as a group. We were great friends. We still are. And I just went out on my own. And my very first show, I remember, was in Swords in County Dublin. It was a charity show. I still do a lot of them. And I remember it was Sean Dunphy, the late, great Sean
Beautiful
Dunphy.
Singer. Yeah.
If I could choose. Sean Dunphy was due to be top of the bill that night. And he never showed. He was late showing up, the traffic or something. And I had to go on in the top of the bill spot.
Were you nervous?
As a solo I was, yeah. I had to change my clothes several times.
Does he still make you laugh, Eileen?
He does. And you know, I think that's the secret to a happy marriage.
Mm.
If your husband can make you laugh after all these years and be friends, I think that's the main thing. If you didn't like each other, like, then you're in trouble. So...
But we've been lucky. Good friends, aren't we?
Yeah.
I can see that actually because I watched the documentary that's going out tomorrow night and that comes across so strongly in it.
Does it? I'm dying to see it.
It's superb. But how come you ended up going to live in America? Because you don't you still live half the time maybe in Florida and half in Ireland?
Yeah. Well,
don't fix the boat.
The first couple of years, we said we'd go for 2 years.
Yeah.
We got our visa and we said, because Brendan used to work in the States an awful lot back then. So we said, we asked the kids, were they interested? And they all said, yes, of course. So we went to the embassy, we got our visa and off we went. And we've been going to Florida for years on holidays, so we always knew that that's where we would end up. So it was just amazing. We found the right place. We're still friendly with all the same people 25 years later that we met out there. A lot of Irish out there, believe it or not. But there's a lovely community. And so,
as a result, I'm a shareholder in Aer Lingus.
Yeah.
You spent a lot of time.
Non-refundable, by the way.
Because the other thing, one of the reasons I suppose you went to the States and did very well was, tell us about how you ended up playing or doing a gig for Frank Sinatra. Wasn't that key to you almost going to America?
Oh, there's no question about it.
Tell us about that.
Well, Eileen and I, we knew that they were in town for the ultimate event, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis and Liza Minnelli. And we kind of knew they'd be staying at the Berkeley Court Hotel. So we said, let's go in one afternoon. We said, we might just happen to see them walking around. So as we were going into the Berkeley Court Hotel, my good friend, Oliver Barry, the great impresario, was coming out. And Oliver said to me, the right man in the right place, he says, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you working tomorrow night? And I was working tomorrow night. But I said to Oliver, no, no, I'm fine. Because I thought he was going to invite me to see the show with Eileen. But no, he said to me, I need you to entertain the trio and their entourage.
The trio being?
Sammy Davis Jr., Liza Minnelli and Frank Sinatra. And I was speechless, which is one of the few times in my life that I was ever speechless. And as it happened, you wouldn't tell me where the gig was on. And it turned out to be in the Horse Show House in Ballsbridge. No lights, no mics, nothing. Just wear a nice tuxedo. Mm. And I was drilled by Sinatra's miners to see what I was going to do. And there were women, by the way. There were two women who looked through me like as if I was in X-ray. And they told me, you can't do this and you can't do that. And I had just perfected, I think, the father of the bride routine, the drunk routine. Mm. And they said, you can't do that. And in those days, you could smoke and drink in, well, you could drink in pubs, but you could smoke. And Sinatra was there with all of his entourage. They were all smoking. And I just said, to hell with it, I'll try the father and bride. So what I did was I got a Guinness bottle and a glass and a cigarette, and I did the father of the bride, and I called him. I said, I looked at him at one stage and I said, I says, you're not Perry Como.
That's right.
And he fell around the place laughing because he loved Perry Como. Yeah. I didn't know that. I could have been kneecapped for less.
Yeah. And I'm in the wings watching all this through a curtain, like tiny little space. It was an out-of-body experience almost to be looking at Brendan standing right in front of these three legends. And we were terrified, and it was going down so well, I couldn't believe the reaction. Like, Sammy Davis was on the floor, literally.
Laughing.
Yeah.
He was a lovely man.
What was Sinatra like?
Lovely.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, really nice.
But it was after that, wasn't it, one of them said to you, you should come to America.
Sammy Davis said to me first, he says, where have you been all our life? And, you know, I didn't know how to answer it. And Sinatra then asked his manager, who has since written a book, Elliot Wiseman, wrote a book. And
you mentioned
me in the book about Sinatra. And he said, we want you to come to America. And Premier Artists was the name of their company. And they looked after my dates.
Where did Danny Donovan, wasn't there a guy?
Danny O'Donovan's people were from Skibbereen.
That's right, there was an Irish connection.
And he ends up living very close to where we live in Florida.
He was in Boca,
He lives in Boca, we live in Jupiter.
Yeah.
In Florida.
And was he part of their entourage?
Yes.
Yeah, and he was part of their management team. He was the one that got the ball rolling for Brendan to start doing the gigs.
Isn't life amazing that if you hadn't walked into the hotel, the Berkeley Court, on that day, bumped into Oliver Barry, you might never have come to Florida.
I think all the best things happen by accident.
Eileen got a lift to the train station to come to Wexford. Yeah. Terry and Claire
Cunningham
brought you out. If his car had broken down on the way, I wouldn't imagine.
I know.
What a life you and would have had without me, imagine.
We then discovered that our paths had crossed several times when we were younger.
Tell me about that.
My very first, you know, when you're a kid on the road, you have a boyfriend. So I'm like 14, 15, and my boyfriend, they used to call him Dahi Locker. I can't even think of his real name. Eamon Gibbs,
yeah.
He lived up the road from me, but he went to school with Brendan. So
he was
years
sitting next to me in
the confirmation photograph, right beside him.
That's
weird. His first girlfriend, Brigine Robinson, went to school with me. So, like,
so there were loads of connections.
There were lots of connections. Yeah,
Eileen actually met my dad, Seamus, before before she met me, because he had been a barman all his life, and he used to work opposite the Theatre Royal. That's how another way I used to meet a lot of the celebrities from theatre, and he then worked as an ambulance assistant. And they used to bring patients.
I was in St. Luke's.
Eileen was up in St. Luke's Hospital.
So I used to meet Seamus a lot.
She was a receptionist. So she met him before I met her, didn't she? Yeah.
The other thing that I found out from the doc I didn't know is that you, in a sense, made, I think Brendan O'Carroll will be happy to say, that you almost found Brendan O'Carroll, didn't you?
Brendan, in actual fact, was a commie waiter at our wedding of 17 people in Pat Quinn's club in Kiltern. Okay. And Brendan made me laugh as a waiter.
Yeah.
And he became, he wasn't even my roadie at the time. He was just my companion. And we used to laugh and joke, and he was so
funny. He was just always funny. Yeah.
But what you mean is, this waiter was at your wedding, Brendan O'Carroll, and you just liked him and said, come and work with me.
Loved him.
And actually, we have a clip, haven't we? We'll play it now. It's Brendan from tomorrow night's documentary, and he's talking about you, Brendan. Let's listen now to Brendan O'Carroll.
Yeah.
It was my 18th birthday. We were on a break of a few days, and he called me and said to me, I need you to come over here. And I said, what's up? I need to talk. I was a bit pissed off. And arrived at the house, came in. So what's up? Well, he said, Eileen's away, and I just want to go for a bit of lunch, but I don't have lunch of my own. I said, you're kidding me. You brought me over here to have lunch. Are you serious? So we walk out to the front door, and I think at the time he had the Jag, he had two motorbikes, he had another car, there was the van. And now, which one will I take? Will I take that? Will I take that? Will I take that? I was going, for God's sake, come on, will you? And he points past this guy and says, I'll take that one. It was a Fiat 127. I said, you don't own that one. And he said, I know I don't. You do. Happy birthday. I pulled up outside my house. My brother went, where did you steal that? I said, no, it's not like the other ones. Just I own this one.
It's a really nice story, though.
Mm.
Yeah, we were good buddies. I was offered a leading role in his movie, by the way. The movie that came up at the time. But I wouldn't take it because they wanted me to sleep with Mrs. Brown.
Yeah, and you couldn't
do
that.
I wouldn't do that, no.
Yeah, no, you definitely couldn't do that. Yeah, there's also lovely stories like Jason Byrne is in it and he's talking about you. And I think it's true. He said you're the only comedian he knows apart from Billy Connolly that when people think about you or anticipate you coming on the stage, they smile before you come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's nice. It's a labour of love for me.
I see it when we're in the supermarket.
Yeah. Go on.
And we're walking along next of all, he's gone missing. And he's surrounded by people remembering and the
tell
laughter.
The truth, mostly women.
Mostly women, yeah. Older women.
They just can't get close enough to me.
But honestly, it's amazing to watch. Now, when we're here in January and the weather is so bad and the gigs are on, I often say, who in their right mind would come out to a show on a night like this? And they come. It's amazing. And we meet everybody the next morning for breakfast and the laugh we have is unbelievable. And it's all the remembering of the days gone by. People come up to us and say, I met you 40 years ago. Do you remember?
But the funny thing is that, you know, back home in America, in Florida or in Boston where our family live, it's the opposite. You go into a supermarket, although Boston's a lot of Irish.
There's a lot of Irish,
But I go into a supermarket, we go in Florida and it's very simple. Nobody knows who we are.
Which is lovely as well. Yeah, we're going to take a break, but I'll bring you two comments so far. Kevin says, I was working with 13 painters in the Braemar Rooms back in the 80s. Brendan was on stage rehearsing and he said we were like the 12 apostles with a white bearded painter at the head of the table having lunch. And another, Elaine says,
oh, they were the fellas that worked in the Sistine Chapel.
Yeah, exactly. I have a tape of Brendan's years ago. My favourite bit was him singing Song for the Myra. I listened to that tape over and over as a teenager. Yeah. I loved it. Thank you.
Song for the Myra.
That's one of my favourites,
Brendan Shine recorded that too.
Yeah.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551. You can email miriam at rte.ie. I'm here this morning with Brendan Grace and his wife Eileen. There's a great documentary going out tomorrow night on RTE 1 at 9.35, all about your life. I want to bring you, there's lots of reaction, Brendan. This person says, when I was 14, my dad had a stroke, but not unlike Brendan. He fought his way back, but his speech was slurred and gait was slightly unsteady. Walking home one night with my mum from a neighbour's house, someone told him he was drunk and disordered. Well, after his stroke, Dad couldn't laugh out loud, but I can still see his shoulders shaking at Brendan's antics on TV. Long life to you both, and thank you for all the fun.
Oh, that's very nice. And funny enough, you know, it's like I had similar problems, but it was through the accident I had a year after the stroke that I lost my gait. Mm. I couldn't do any stand-up comedy anymore. Mm. I mean, at the moment, I sit down doing comedy.
Okay, so tell me what. So, when did you have your mini stroke? Can you remember?
4 or 5 years ago, yeah, last July.
Mm. Were you with him? Do you know?
I wasn't. And myself and Amanda, my daughter, had just left 2 days previous to go to Spain.
Yeah.
And Brendan and Terry, our son in law, left us to the airport and he was fine, didn't notice anything. So, Brian, I got a phone call. I was only 2 days there. And it was Brian, Brendan's manager, called. He says, I hate to do this. Yeah. I know you've just arrived, but he says, I'm very worried about Brendan. He said, tonight on the show, he got several things mixed up and Brendan would be very now spot on what he's doing. So he got the father of the bride mixed up with the priest and Brian would have been the one who would have noticed most. People in the audience, Brian said, probably wouldn't have noticed, but he did. He says, you know, I'm just very concerned. He says, I think he's having a stroke. Well, I needn't tell you, when I heard that, I said to Brian, make sure he gets to the hospital immediately. And I'll be home. So he did. Terry brought Brendan to Galway, the University Hospital in Galway that night, because he had to go back to Killaloe, get his bag, get himself sorted. And he ended up in the hospital. When I got home, he had, you know, the way your mouth got disfigured. So he had that. But it already now, this was day three, it was starting to get better. Day four, he was back to himself. And then by the weekend, he was fine.
Well, I remember my doctor saying to me at the time, he said, you know, he says, you're in the lucky 10%. Yeah. Lucky 10%.
Yeah.
Because he said, really, only 10% of the people who have a stroke come back to normal.
Yeah.
And it's all about the speed. I suppose you went to the hospital.
That's what
very
it is.
Quick,
it's
very
going fast. Yeah.
And how terrifying was that, Brendan? Did you know something was happening to you?
I knew something was happening, yeah.
You got very disorientated.
I got disorientated. Yeah. But not only that, I kept my calm.
Yeah.
It's like, for instance, you know when they give this Heimlich manoeuvre when somebody gets something caught in their throat? Well, if anything like that happens to me, I stay calm.
Yeah.
And I try to get it right.
Yeah,
that probably
And I have to say now that looking back on it, I'm thrilled that I'm still going strong.
Yeah, but it does change how you look at yourself and how you look at your life. And what you need to do to make changes, you know.
Yeah.
You take better care of yourself. It's like you get another chance.
Yeah.
So you're far more aware of everything you're doing.
Yeah.
And what was the accident then? You've mentioned a few times, Brendan, that happened. Was that a year later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happened there?
I just fell down a hole. And my whole atmosphere went wrong because I was nervous of where I walked.
Mm-hmm. You know, his gait went off. He just lost his
walking on rough ground. For even still, you know, I'm very, very wary, and I use a walking cane. Not always.
Mm.
I try not to use it.
I prefer if you use it when you're out in a crowd, because I'm always afraid of people coming towards and that might bump off them. Mm-hmm. So I think when people see a cane, they're, you know, they keep their distance. They don't come right into your space.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, you're safer.
Yeah, you're respected.
Yeah.
And did you say you sit down doing your act now a lot?
Yeah. And I've made virtue of it because
Dave Allen sat.
I go to Michael O'Doherty, the great energy person. He's
he does bioenergy.
Of,
you know Michael O'Doherty?
He's done lots
actually
of
tell me about him.
Things, yeah. Well, he brought
Michael
Flatley back. Michael Flatley had a mysterious illness and he brought him right back. And it was Michael Flatley who told me about him. And I went to visit him. And he, through his energy, the way he brings the energy through you,
okay,
I found myself gaining strength. And I've sent lots of people to him since. And they, it's an energy thing. Bioenergy, isn't that what they call it?
So he just brings the energy back into you, is that it?
He finds the energy force within your body.
He doesn't touch you. No. He just stands, you can actually feel, I could feel my blood moving as if there was a bulldozer.
It's like your circulation gets moving.
Yeah.
But look, I'm looking at you here this morning. You look the same. I'm a bit like Jason Byrne, as I said earlier. I just look at you and you make me smile anyway. But you look, for my listeners, if they're worried about you, you look really
can't
healthy.
See you.
I know. But I'm just
sitting
saying.
Sitting there in your negligee. How do I look in the pyjamas?
Very attractive.
That's why they're tight.
Yeah.
But it's bold. It's Sunday
when
morning.
You look back, I was looking back, obviously, in preparation for this, at some of the Late Lates with Gay, of course. I mean, they were huge moments, weren't they?
Well, it started on the Late Late Show.
I liked so much.
Yeah.
Like everybody, Ballygown, Bailey's, Brendan O'Carroll, myself, like millions of people.
I just watched the clip the other night of Boyzone.
Yeah.
When they were
there
dancing.
Yeah.
And that's how it was. I mean, my first television appearance was with Shea Healy in Ballacheet with the Ginger Men. I went along to, we did a show and it's wiped. It's something that has been wiped since. And my very first broadcaster that I ever knew was Pat Kenny. I knew Pat Kenny before this place was built, well,
how
it was
come?
Being built. I was in Radio Air in Henry Street. And the messenger in Henry Street at the time was this tall, skinny fellow called Pat Kenny.
That's amazing.
He was taking notes from one studio to the next. And it was there that I met Brendan Conwell, one of the great actors of all time. And it was Brendan Conwell who actually started, who gave me the nucleus of an idea as a drunk. Benny Conwell was the best drunk that I ever saw, and he was sober, and he was so funny.
So much love here. Look, I'm going to read a lot of it to you. Mary in Dublin 4 says, Miriam, I remember Brendan Grace when he lived in the Woodbine estate in Coolock. Sean O'Connell in Clontarf says, I went to a business gig upstairs in the Shelburne Hotel in the 90s. It was a beautiful summer's night and the windows were open. People started to stop and listen outside. Brendan sat straddling the windowsill and entertained everybody all night. He's only very entertaining and he's a lovely person. Another Sean McGuinness says, I had many a great night with Brendan and Ireland. He's not only a genius, but an absolute gentleman. Long and happy life to them both.
Dublin
God bless
City
them.
Love you, Sean.
Paula in Ashford says, Brendan is one of the kindest people I've ever met. He sent me a CD featuring my dad's favourite song, Dublin in the Rare Old Times, after my dad passed away. I've almost worn it out. It's played that often. Dennis says, I was at a Brendan Gray show in Bantry in 07 when he sang a song for Maureen O'Hara, who was at the show at the time.
Yeah.
I'll be reading these all day, so I'll give you one more. Thanks for the laughs, Brendan. I went to see you in the INEC years ago and he got me up onto the stage and my late husband and our two sons just laughed for days afterwards. You're very involved as well. Tell me about this single you've recorded, the Forget Me Nots, because this is important.
Yes.
All the funds, as Sinead Grennan explained to me, are going to the Alzheimer's Association. Tell me about this.
Yeah, Engaging Dementia, as you know, Miriam, is the name of the thing. And it's a song that I recorded that David Soule, the great actor and singer, gave me, called The Dutchman. And I recorded it 34 years ago. Imagine that. 34 years ago. And I was singing at a party in the Abbey Glen Hotel in Clifton. And that was the night I got married to
Sharon.
Oh, merciful.
That was another charity gig.
Yeah, that was.
That's your second
wife. Yeah. It was a special
night.
Poor
Sharon.
Yeah.
She
was my wife. And she wouldn't come on the honeymoon, though. But I remember Eleanor Shanley, Donal Lunny, and Sharon and the whole lot. And I sang The Dutchman a cappella. And when I was finished singing it,
Eleanor said to you.
Yeah, said, the words of that song.
She thought about it, she said.
Are very moving.
Yeah.
And I'd been singing the song for 34 years, and all of a sudden I realised it's a song literally about dementia.
Never dawned on
it's
us before.
It's about a loving wife called Margaret, who is caring for her husband, the same way as Nora Owen does about her beloved
husband.
Bride.
Yeah, so moving.
And that's how it all came around. And we took the original recording. I don't know how they did it, but I know that Brian and Donal Lunny were able to drop the recording of the Forget Me Nots on top of this, and it was perfect. And it came out as a beautiful song. with the Forget-Me-Nots choir singing with me.
And you know, the best thing for people living with dementia is music. They just love music.
And actually mentioning Nora Owen, she has just texted in to say, Brendan, many thanks for singing with the Forget-Me-Nots Dementia Friendly Choir I'm recording with us. Which is great. Thanks for Nora for that. And also Siobhan of Farnham says, Mary, many years ago, I was due to sing in the Embankment in Blessington, but my accompanist did not turn up. And Brendan very kindly accompanied me in guitar, playing a beautiful Danny Boy. He was great and very kind. Thank you. I'm still singing Danny Boy. Oh. That's Siobhan of Farnham. We're actually going to go out listening to that beautiful song you've recorded with the Forget-Me-Nots. And all, I said, proceeds, as you know, going to the Alzheimer's Society. I think that's all we have time for today. Brendan, Grace, Eileen, I could have talked to you for another hour.
We will again.
We'll be back to your house. I think Marion Finucane would be a bit annoyed me if I talked to the next day. She would.
Well, I get to see Marion.
Yeah, you will. I'll introduce you now.
Can I wave at her in the studio and make her laugh?
She'll be coming down the stairs
and say hello. I think Francis Brennan is in with her.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was up there now.
But listen, just to say, carrying his flag. Documentary and all those people you mentioned in this programme, they're all in this documentary tour now, which is about you, Brendan Grace, going out on RT1 at 9.35. Thanks so much for coming in today. Today, our BCO was Carolyn Dempsey on Soundguard, Duffy, producer Shannon Gorm. We're going out listening to Brendan Grace, which he recorded with the Forget-Me-Nots, all proceeds going to Alzheimer's. Míle buíochas.
Dutchman's not the kind of man to keep his thumb jammed in the dam that holds his dreams in. But that's a secret only Margaret knows. When Amsterdam is golden in the morning, Margaret brings him breakfast. She believes him. The tulips bloom beneath the snow. He's mad as he can be, but Margaret only sees that sometimes. She often sees her unborn children in his eyes.
Let us go to the banks of the ocean, where the walls rise above the Tiber Sea.